Hi, everyone, and welcome to this reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. This is the Tuesday, September 27th edition, is brought to you here on the morning of Wednesday, September the 28th. Hope you're having a great day, everyone. Great start to your day. Before anything, we're going to start off with the forecast for today through Saturday. And for today, you can expect a cooler day from what we've even had. It was high of 64, right around 64 degrees yesterday. For today, though, a high of just 61 degrees. We saw a very cold overnight low in the upper 20s is what we're looking at from the forecast here. Actual temps, not really sure since I'm recording this on Tuesday afternoon, but that was diagnosed to be 29 degrees for the overnight. For today, Wednesday, expect high 61 degrees, mild winds out of the south up to 8 miles per hour, and plenty of sunshine. That low for tonight, 34 degrees. For tomorrow, your Thursday, expect sunshine and breezy conditions. Winds from the south up to 16 miles per hour, a high 68 degrees, warmer for your Thursday. Thursday night, a low 42 degrees. Friday, warmer yet, a high of 72 degrees, with partly sunny and breezy conditions, a high of 72, those winds from the south and southeast up to 20 miles per hour. Low 44 Friday night, and for Saturday, expect a high of 76 degrees. Very nice, mostly sunny and pleasant out and about, as that's your forecast here in the Mason City Globe-Gazette. But again, for today, expect a high of 61 degrees with mild wind and plenty of sun, as we're taking a look on the, rather at the front page headlines here. Andrew Halp here reading this addition to you. The Children's Museum organizes fundraiser. More than 180 foam hogs take to the sky at the Win Pigs Fly event. Also, DJer, Reynolds' new ad, a figment. Reynolds' spot includes images of black official who is not DJer. That written by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. And then also here on the front page, Worth County residents speak out against hog confinement. More on that story, where the application to build a 4,990-head operation has been met with opposition, a story by Mary Loden. But before anything else, we'll get to our headline story. And the photo at the top shows North Iowa Children's Museum volunteers cheering on the plane that dropped foam pigs during the Win Pigs Fly fundraiser at Plain Old Pumpkins that happened on Saturday. There's a photo of a plane coming down, getting close to him. Looks to be a crop duster type plane as he's about ready to make that drop. And there's two gentlemen in the foreground with their backs to the camera. One is clapping as the plane is coming, or it appears to be clapping. This is written by Abby Koch of the Globe-Gazette. Pigs really do fly when they are supporting a community organization. The North Iowa Children's Museum held its inaugural Win Pigs Fly fundraiser at Plain Old Pumpkins on Saturday. The main feature of the event was seeing more than 180 foam pigs soar. It is just something different. Fundraising is hard, so to make it exciting and interesting for people, this is a fun thing, said North Iowa Children's Museum Director Rachel Wumkes. Participants bought tickets for entries that corresponded with a numbered foam pig. At 10 a.m., 184 foam swine were dropped from a plane. The three foam toys that landed closest to the center of a target received prizes. We are really pleased with how many pigs we sold, and Plain Old Pumpkins is a great spot to be. And kids can just be kids. North Iowa Children's Museum President Lorena Malcha said. Malcha, who organized a similar event in her hometown, presented the idea of dropping foam pigs as a fundraiser to other directors. Wumkes said, "At first, it seemed like there were too many what-ifs. It was kind of like a magical thing that just fell into place with being able to get a pilot and then having it out here at Plain Old Pumpkins. It just worked out really well," Wumkes said. When Pigs Fly is the second fundraiser the museum has hosted, with the first being an interactive station set up at the Color the Wind Festival in Clear Lake earlier this year. Alongside When Pigs Fly, both will be annual fundraising events, according to Wumkes. Funds are being put toward building a home for the museum. "We love the community support, and Clear Lake and the surrounding area is so family-oriented," said Malka. "We would love to build a children's museum for them." Before I go any further here, the photo in the center of the page shows Etsy in green and Vivi Vermeer Two young ladies there playing in a pile of corn kernels at the Plain Old Pumpkins during the When Pigs Fly fundraiser in North Iowa Children's Museum, for the North Iowa Children's Museum on Saturday. And it looks there, they've got some Tonka trucks, they've got some shovels. Looks like they're having a good time playing in the corn. The story goes on. The nonprofit launched its capital campaign in early September. Wumkes and Malcha said the organization is hoping to raise $5 million to make the museum a reality. To get to the museum up and running will take an estimated $2 million, with $3 million placed in an endowment to provide a steady stream of income. North Iowa Children's Museum is working with the City of Cedar Lake to see what sites are available for the building. The interest from that can just keep the museum alive and sustainable for years to come, said Wumkes. Attendees at the event could look at renderings and floor plans of the future museum. Wumkes said it really brought it to life for people. It is more of a regional thing than just in one community, said Wumkes. I'm hoping we can pull from Algona, Britt, Forest City, Osage, Norris Springs, and Northwood, just all around. Well, families enjoyed other fall activities at the event, such as the piglet petting zoo, tractor pedal cars, and a pumpkin ring toss. In addition, all of Plain Old Pumpkins fun was available for the kids. We're just really excited to get this up and running. It became more of a reality just in the last couple weeks, getting corporate donations in and really kicking off the capital campaign, said Wumkes. For more information about the North Iowa Children's Museum, go to www.northiowachildrensmuseum.com or Facebook, or their Facebook page. These photos here show Kayla Halsney about to launch a mini pumpkin at the fundraiser. Also, it shows another photo here of Alana Hemmings, and she's in a big round cylinder enjoying one of the activities during the fundraiser, and then AJ Gappa on a, looks to be a pedal go-kart, getting some help from his grandfather at the fundraiser. That all happened on Saturday. One photo here does show the plane dropping the foam pigs during the When Pigs Fly fundraiser. All right, now that's the story from the front page. Moving on to other front page news. Degere, Reynolds' new ad of Figment. Reynolds' spot includes images of a black official who is not Degere. This is written by Aaron Murphy of the Globe-Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines, where Dieter Degere says the latest campaign ad from Governor Kim Reynolds, which shows a black official who is not Degere calling to defund the police, showcases that the Republican incumbent is not focused on issues relevant to Iowa. She doesn't even talk about elected officials in the state of Iowa. That's unfortunate. You see images throughout her ad that aren't even representing Iowa, Degere, the Democrat and small businesswoman from Des Moines who is running against Reynolds in this fall's election, said Monday. None of what she said was founded in this state. And it's unfortunate. Honestly, I think it's short-sighted and lazy, but it's also unfortunate, Degere said. What she showed Iowans was a figment of her imagination, not what Iowans need for them. In Reynolds' latest campaign ad, she talks about what she believes are problems facing other areas of the country before pivoting to say to viewers, "Aren't you glad you live in Iowa?" A Reynolds campaign spokesman said the ad highlights issues that are facing other states in comparison with Iowa. In the ad, Reynolds cites attacks on police, open borders, paying people not to work. The campaign ad contrasts the failed policies supported by liberal Democrats across the country with the common-sense leadership of Governor Reynolds, Reynolds campaign spokesman Pat Garrett said. The ad opens with Reynolds watching a news clip of Missouri Democratic U.S. Representative Cori Bush calling to defund the police, and then Bush, like Degere, is a black woman. Degere has on multiple occasions said she does not support any policy that would be considered defunding law enforcement agencies. Degere said she has discussed many issues with law enforcement officials during her campaign, including addressing racial disparities in the criminal justice system and recidivism in the state corrections department. I talk a great deal with law enforcement, and they've been part of my campaign since the beginning, Degere said. They have to be partners in this work with us, which means that they need the resources to be able to do their job better. But law enforcement is telling me right now, we're not having conversations about defunding. We're having conversations about needing more resources. Libertarian Party candidate Rick Stewart also is on the ballot in Iowa's campaign for governor. The election is November 8th, and early voting starts October 19th. And then on to our final front page story now. Worth County residents speak out against hog confinement. Application to build a 4,990-head operation have been met with opposition. That's written by Mary Loden of the Globe-Gazette. It was standing room only as the Worth County Board of Supervisors held a public meeting regarding the application from Summit Ag LLP to put a 4,990-head concentrated animal feeding operation within the county. After 19 speakers discussed their reasons for opposing a large hog confinement in their neighborhood for nearly an hour, Supervisors A.J. Stone and Mark Smeby reopened the regular meeting to accept the Iowa Department of Natural Resources report that the LLP met the basic requirements of having a manure management plan. However, the two supervisors were of split mind when it came to approving Summit Pork the Fourth LLP's application to build. Smeby was in favor while Stone was opposed. Since Supervisor Enos Loberg was absent, there was no quorum. The decision was split, and the motion to accept the application did not pass, but the application does not require approval from the board. They can have three nays, and the application will still go to the DNR, Worth County resident Russ Johnson said. County control is gone. Even state control is gone. They, the state, would have to make legislation to actually stop them. That is, the industrial ag companies. Johnson said neighboring property owners had barely any notification of the proposed CAFO, prompting him to ask for the matter to be added to the board's agenda. Residents Cindy Mueller, Heather Butler, and Aaron Thomas spoke in opposition. The three each own businesses, boarding and training horses with a therapeutic riding program, providing daycare and raising and selling organic pork and chickens, respectively. Each said they fear the CAFO will be a huge detriment to their businesses. In addition, comments were made about the smell of the manure and rotting carcasses, increased traffic on roads bringing hogs in and out, and the sound of thousands of squealing hogs. Several residents said they choose to live in the area specifically because there were no local hog confinements. Large hog confinement operations often see a lower property tax rate as well. Worth County Assessor Cindy Thompson explained that ag land is assessed at up to $2,000 an acre, while commercial property is assessed at upwards of $20,000 an acre. Susie Quam, another concerned Worth County resident, joined the public meeting via Zoom. She said she has lived in the area close to 30 years, and she monitors the DNR versus CAFOs very closely. As of mid-September, she said the Iowa DNR maps shows there are 42 million swine in Iowa, and that doesn't count the operations below 1,800 head per building. Bruce Rastetter and Jeff Brocky have formed a partnership, and they plan to infiltrate Worth County, plus the surrounding counties, Quam said. Just because something isn't illegal doesn't make it right, Johnson said. Johnson invited Representative Jane Bloomingdale, to the meeting. I want her to see firsthand how they operate, Johnson said. Bloomingdale declined to comment other than to say she was only at the meeting to listen. Even though opposition can't stop the proposed CAFO on a county level, we're still looking for a show of force. We want more people to be aware of it and get the word out, Johnson said. Johnson said the installation of the operation could still stop should Summit Farms or Jeff Brocky decide to pull the application. But the problem is these people live in a world where there is opposition all the time. They take it as just business as usual. They don't care about the communities, and that was our biggest point to bring up at the Board of Supervisors, Johnson said. Well, Mary Loden covers city and county government for the Globe Gazette. You can reach her by emailing mary.loden@globegazette.com. And the photo here at the right shows Caitlin Goley from Iowa Citizens for Responsible Agriculture showing a 2020 map from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. The red dots on the map of the state of Iowa represent animal units over 1,000, and the green dots represent animal units between 500 to 1,000. Worth and Cerro Gordo counties make up the empty spot at the north central part of the map. There we go. So not a lot of hog confinements in that area. All right, moving on now. We took care of everything on page one here, page A1. And the follow-on stories were on page A2, so we move on now to page A3 here of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. This is the Tuesday, September 27th edition. Two Iowa Care Facility residents freeze to death. This is a strange story, written by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. One worker faces a murder charge. Two Iowa caregivers accused of failing to protect elderly Iowans who froze to death on their watch are now facing very different consequences. One of the workers has been criminally charged with second-degree murder and faces up to 50 years of imprisonment if convicted, while the other is facing no criminal charges and has been allowed to keep her nursing license. The murder charge is highly unusual for a case involving a care facility worker accused of neglect. I can't say definitely that the state has never charged anyone with second-degree murder in these circumstances, but if they have, I'm not aware of it, said Matthew S. Sheely, an assistant state public defender who is working the case. The two resident deaths were tragic and avoidable, said Toby Edelman, senior policy attorney for the Nonprofit Center for Medicare Advocacy and a nationally recognized expert in senior care. Many people in each facility are responsible and should be held accountable for their obvious failures to keep their residents safe, or keep the residents safe. Every Iowan should be concerned about these tragic deaths, said John Hale, a consultant and advocate for older Iowans. He said while Iowans should insist on justice for the families involved, all too often it's the direct care staff members that get blamed for these tragedies, and in some cases that may be warranted if they failed to act when they could have. He said in many cases, facilities have a lack of sufficient staff, provide scant training, or use temporary workers who are not familiar with residents or the facility's procedures. When those additional factors exist, the responsibility for tragedies goes beyond the direct care staff on duty. It also goes to supervisory staff, facility management, facility owners, and corporate directors, he said. The first of the two cases involves 95-year-old Elaine Creasy, who on December 9th, 2021, froze to death outside Keelson Harbor Assisted Living Center in Spirit Lake. The second case involves 77-year-old Lynn Harriet Stewart, a former state social worker who froze to death on January 21st of this year, 2022, outside Courtyard Estates at Hawthorne Crossing in Bondurant. According to state records, Creasy wandered from her room at Keelson Harbor and exited the building shortly after 10 p.m. on December the 8th, 2021. Because Creasy was known to wander, the staff was instructed to perform hourly visual checks on her, and the exit door was equipped with an alarm to alert the staff in case someone left the building. But according to state records, the temp agency worker who was assigned to check on Creasy during the night, identified in Board of Nursing records as registered nurse Brooke Arndt of Lake Park, repeatedly failed to confirm Creasy was in her room and didn't investigate the cause of the door alarm. With Creasy outside, a short distance from the exit door that had locked behind her, the temperature dropped to a wind chill of 14 degrees. About 7 a.m. the next day, a worker went to Creasy's room to check on her and noticed she was not in her apartment. A search was initiated, and within a half hour, employees found her unresponsive, lying on the ground outside the facility's memory care unit. The staff summoned an ambulance that transported Creasy to a nearby hospital where she was pronounced dead on arrival. The medical examiner later reported that his findings of hypothermia due to exposure were consistent with Creasy having exited the building about 10 p.m. the previous day. Nurse, I wasn't trained on bed checks. According to state inspectors, Arndt told investigators she had performed all of the required visual safety checks on Creasy between midnight and 5 a.m., although she added she had not been trained on how to perform such checks. She reportedly told the inspectors that when she performed bed checks, she would open the door to a resident's room, leave the light off, walk in a few steps, and look for a silhouette of the resident in bed. She allegedly reported that she thought she had seen Creasy in bed each time she checked her room that night. A review of the door alarm system at Keelson Harbor allegedly showed the alarm had sounded at 10:07 p.m., indicating someone had exited the building and was shut off and reset by the staff 9 minutes later. When interviewed, Arndt allegedly told inspectors that she had silenced the door alarm without checking on the residents or searching the area to see who might have left the building. Another worker at the home had told her not to worry about it, she said. Arndt also stated she was not sure what the door alarm signified or what had triggered it. Inspectors later reported and alleged she had not received any training on emergencies and door alarms. The state inspector's department fined Keelson Harbor $10,000 for staff training violations. Arndt was not criminally charged, but the Iowa Board of Nursing charged her with committing an act that causes injury to a patient and with failure to properly assess, evaluate, or accurately document a patient's status. As part of a settlement agreement, the board placed Arndt's license on 1 year of probation and required her to complete 30 hours of additional professional education. Creasy's family is now suing both Keelson Harbor and the temp agency that employed Arndt, accusing them of negligence and reckless disregard for another's safety. The two companies deny any wrongdoing, and a trial is scheduled for August 15, 2023. The family has alleged Creasy's hands and knees were covered in abrasions when she was found, indicating that she had been crawling around in the cold outside for some time. They say Creasy suffered immensely, both physically and mentally, before she passed away. Well, video shows worker walking around facility. A few weeks after Creasy died, 200 miles east of Spirit Lake, Lynn Stewart froze to death outside the Courtyard Estates Assisted Living Center in Bondurant. As with Creasy, Stewart was known to wander and was supposed to have been checked every hour. State inspection records indicate a worker at the home, identified in court records as Catherine Forkpa, age 31 of Ankeny, was assigned to check on Stewart throughout the night. The center's records show that Stewart exited the building about 9:40 p.m., triggering an alarm. By that time, a separate alarm attached to the door of Stewart's room had already been tripped. The two alarms triggered a series of alerts that appeared on a desktop computer used by the care's facility staff and on the portable devices carried by each of the workers. But on the night in question, Forkpa was the only person working Stewart's area of the building, and surveillance video allegedly showed that instead of responding to the alarms, she walked around the memory care unit for hours. The temperature outside, meanwhile, was dropping and eventually dipped to 11 degrees below zero, state inspectors later reported. For 3 hours of her shift, Forkpa was allegedly off camera and unaccounted for, although police would later say the cameras trained on Stewart's room showed that during her entire shift, Forkpa made no effort to enter Stewart's room and check on her. Executive director slept through phone alerts. This is the next issue here. At 5:30 a.m., the video showed Forkpa grabbing some breakfast for herself and walking to the dining room where she sat and ate. At 6:10 a.m., a worker who had been assigned to another area of the building looked at the nursing staff's desktop computer and saw the door alarm alerts for both Stewart's room and the exit door at the end of Stewart's hallway. She immediately alerted Forkpa, and the two quickly located Stewart outside on the ground with her body wedged against the exit door. An ambulance was summoned and paramedics rushed Stewart to a nearby hospital. Stewart, they later reported, was so stiff and cold they initially couldn't record a body temperature. She had ice freezing on her hand, the paramedics reported, and there were abrasions on her head and hands. Before the ambulance reached the hospital, Stewart went into cardiac arrest. Paramedic Tim Huff and his crew tried to restart her heart, but they were unsuccessful. Stewart was pronounced dead at the hospital. Forkpa, who had worked at Courtyard Estates for 7 months, was fired and four other employees were given written warnings for their failure to respond to the door alarms, according to state records. During the subsequent state investigation, the facility's executive director told inspectors that when she is at home, she receives text message alerts when door alarms are triggered at the facility. She said that on the night in question, she received a long series of alerts triggered by the two door alarms, but she didn't hear them as she slept. Screenshots of the executive director's phone indicate she received the first alert on her phone at 9:44 p.m. and continued to receive them every 5 minutes throughout the night, inspectors alleged. The facility's on-call registered nurse received a similar series of alerts on her phone. She allegedly told inspectors she had noticed the recurring alerts but failed to respond to them because she was at home with her family and because she went to bed around 9:30 p.m. The nurse reportedly told inspectors that in the past, she had ignored alerts that were specific to Stewart's room because of mechanical defects that caused the particular alarm to trigger constantly. Other employees, including Forkpa, reported the same problem to inspectors. Caregiver charged with murder. The state fined Courtyard Estates $10,000 and cited it for having failed to give Forkpa the required 8 hours of dementia training during her first month on the job, instead giving her only 4.75 hours of training. Courtyard Estates acknowledged the problem and later reported to the state that the training issue was corrected by having Forkpa fired. Forkpa now faces a charge of second-degree murder by dependent adult abuse. If convicted on that charge, she faces a term of imprisonment not to exceed 50 years and would have to serve 35 years before becoming eligible for parole. Forkpa, who immigrated to the United States from Africa in 2004, said she doesn't believe the criminal charge is warranted. "I know in my heart I would never do anything to hurt anyone," she told the Iowa Capitol Dispatch. Polk County Attorney John Sarcone declined to comment on the case. A trial is scheduled for November 14th. Police reports indicate that even before Stewart exited the building that night, there were signs, unnoticed by the staff, she was preparing to leave. According to the police, Stewart appeared to have spent some time collecting her clothing and other belongings and carrying them down the hallway to the exit. She set a bag of personal items next to the door and draped some clothes over a nearby railing before walking out into the cold night air with the door locking behind her. She had done this sort of thing in the past, according to state inspectors, telling the staff at Courtyard Estates that she was packing up her things and going home. All right, that written by the Iowa Capitol Dispatch. You can talk to editor Kathy Obradovich by emailing info@iowacapital, spelled C-A-P-I-T-A-L, dispatch.com. Moving on now to page 4A before we hit our halfway point here in the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. Some short stories here in the digest section on page A4. Spending bill has $12 billion in Ukraine aid, Dateline Washington, where more than $12 billion in Ukraine-related aid will be included as part of a stopgap spending bill that would fund the federal government into mid-December, a person familiar with the legislation said Monday. The funding package, which Congress is scheduled to consider this week, will also provide disaster assistance, including for Jackson, Mississippi, where improvements are needed for the city's water treatment system after its main facility malfunctioned in late August, leaving many stranded without clean water. Also in the package is money to help households afford water heating and funding to assist Afghans in resettling in the U.S. And it will reauthorize user fees that the Food and Drug Administration relies on to fund some of the most critical programs the agency undertakes, such as product safety reviews. A procedural Senate vote on the bill is scheduled for Tuesday evening. Both chambers of Congress must approve legislation by the end of Friday, which is the end of the fiscal year, to prevent a partial government shutdown. From there we go to Snowden granted Russian citizenship, Dateline Moscow, Russia. Russia, on Monday, granted citizenship to former American intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who fled prosecution after he revealed highly classified U.S. surveillance programs to capture communications and data from around the world. A decree signed Monday by Russian President Vladimir Putin listed Snowden as one of 75 foreign citizens listed as being granted Russian citizenship. After fleeing the U.S. in 2013, Snowden was granted permanent Russian residency in 2020 and said at the time that he planned to apply for Russian citizenship without renouncing his U.S. citizenship. Ties between Washington and Moscow are already at their lowest point in decades following Putin's decision to launch what the Kremlin has dubbed a special military operation in Ukraine. All right, with that being said, we're at the halfway point here of this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. This is the Tuesday, September 27th edition. Andrew Halp with you here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, well then please give us a call at the office at 515-243-6833 or toll free 1-877-404-4747. Typically at this time we would take a look at the obituaries. However, since there are none listed, we only have one death notice, and that is for Fred W. Wendt, W-E-N-D-T, is how the last name is spelled, age 83 of Norris Springs, who died Saturday, September 24th, at the Norris Springs Care Center in Norris Springs. Arrangements are with the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel in Mason City. All right, from there we move on to the world of sports, as there's no opinions for today either. Prep volleyball, Riceville and St. Ansgar win 5 each on weekend. That's written by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. It wasn't just Osage's volleyball team that had multiple victories on Saturday. The other two Mitchell County schools, that'd be Riceville and St. Ansgar, each went 5-1 at its respective weekend tournaments on Saturday. The Wildcats dominated their way at the Decorah Invite, sweeping South Winneshiek, MFL Marmac, Postville, and Kingsland, plus triumphing over Central Elkader, in 3 sets. Their lone loss was in 3 sets to Clayton Ridge. Of the 4 sweeps that totaled 8 sets, Riceville won by at least 3 points in 7 of them. It has gone 8-2 since winning its final 3 matches at the walk-on invite last weekend. 3 attackers finished with at least 25 kills, paced by 30 from Camden Orth. Morgan Fair distributed 88 assists over the 6 matches and had 23 digs in the back row, while Madison Maurer paced the defensive with 39 digs. St. Ansgar posted 5 sweeps, all in comfortable fashion over North Iowa, West Hancock, Southeast Valley, Garner, Hatfield, Ventura, and Belmont Clemmy. The Saints' only loss was to Bishop Garrigan. They won the first set but couldn't maintain their momentum and dropped the last 2. Aspen Falk hit the century mark in 6 matches with an even 100 assists. Her top attacker was Madison Hillman with 44, but underclassmen Amelia Porish, Ava Falk, and Lindsay Cruz each had double-digit kills. Kinsey Anderson led the back row with 41 digs. Lake Mills gets 2 wins in loaded tourney. The Class 2A number 15 Bulldogs went 2-2 on Saturday at the Nevada Cubs Tournament, sweeping Carroll and Glenwood, then falling to number 3A number 1 Des Moines Christian and 4A number 14 Norwalk in straight sets. Against the Lions, the toughest team Lake Mills has played this season, it was in a competitive first set that was decided by Des Moines Christian winning the set 21-19. The Lions then finished off the sweep with a 21-13 victory in set 2. The Bulldogs needed extra points to stave off Glenwood and triumphed 21-14, 26-24, and they coasted past Carroll 21-13, 21-16 as well. Norwalk edged them 21-15 and then 21-13. No stats for Lake Mills was published online. From there, Forest City claims 3 wins in Central Iowa. The Indians may have cemented themselves at bare minimum a home regional quarterfinal game after beating fellow 3A programs Clarion, Goldfield, Dowse, and Algona in straight sets at the Boone Invitational on Saturday. The match against the Bulldogs was tighter, needing a late push to nab a 23-21, 21-19 victory. Versus the Cowgirls, Forest City cruised by 21-14 and 21-18. It also nabbed a 3-set victory over Grandview Christian. The Indians' 2 losses was another 3-set match versus Grandview Christian and a straight set setback against Boone. Jaden Jerome and Jalen Hovanga each recorded over 30 assists, 25 kills, and 25 digs for the Indians over the course of 5 matches. Bethany Warren chipped in 12 kills, and Emma Anderson paced the back row with 54 digs. From there we go to Mason City, clipped in 4 losses. The River Hawks went 1-4. At the Spencer Invite on Saturday, falling in straight sets to Lamar's, Humboldt, West Lyon, and Central Lyon. Of those 4 defeats in 8 sets, 5 of them had a final score within 5 points. We were competitive in every match and were a couple of plays away from getting to third sets and winning more matches, Mason City head coach Kurt Claussen said. We needed more consistency with our digging and passing to be more successful. The lone win of the day came against the host Tigers as the Riverhawks rebounded from a back-and-forth first set loss to triumph 20-22, 21-16, and 16-14. Megan Tobin led Mason City's efforts at the front of the net for the tournament with 27 kills, while Alexis Heft chipped in 17 and Ellie Kata finished with 16. Ella Turk dished out 69 assists, and Kylie Trappi had 27 digs. Tobin was nearly perfect from the service line, and Chloe Callanan had 11 assisted blocks. Well, GHV edges West Hancock and Algona. After losing the opening set, the Cardinals rebounded with a dominant second set win and clipped the Eagles in the third to triumph 17-21, 21-16, and 15-10 at the Bishop Garrigan Invite on Saturday. It was one of two wins for GHV on the day, as it also swept Southeast Valley 21-14, 21-19. The Cardinals were swept by the host Golden Bears, St. Ansgar, and North Iowa. None of their stats or final score from their match versus Belmont Clemmy were published online. West Hancock lost in straight sets to the other five teams in the tournament field. It did not publish stats from the setbacks against GHV and Belmont Clemmy. In the other four matches, Cameron Eccles dished out six assists and Shelby Gopal recorded four kills and six digs. Well, that written by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. And back to the front page of the sports section, we have Cyclones prepare for next great challenge. And it shows here at the top photo, the large photo in the story, Iowa State running back Jarrell Brock runs from Baylor defensive lineman Gabe Hall during the second half of the Cyclones 31-24 loss Saturday in Ames. Well, the headline, Cyclones prepare for next great challenge. Big 12 road opener at unbeaten Kansas awaits Iowa State. That's written by Rob Gray, special to the Globe Gazette, Dateline Ames, where Dimitri Stanley remembered. The native Coloradan chose to stay home for the first four seasons of his college football career, but never forgot one of the first teams that came calling for his speedy services. That would be Iowa State. And now he's a Cyclone. The culture, it was big for me, said Stanley, a former four-star recruit who caught his first touchdown pass for ISU in Saturday's 31-24 loss at Baylor at Jack Trice Stadium. Iowa State, when I was a junior in high school, was one of the first schools to offer me, so just the fact that they came back for the second round and still believed in me, that spoke volumes to who the coaches were as people, but not only that, but just the culture of Iowa State. Stanley, whose touchdown pass from Hunter Decker spanned 24 yards, will find out just how strong that culture is when the Cyclones try to shake off the effects of Saturday's mistaken-laden loss and refocus in advance of a road trip to suddenly resurgent Kansas, 4-0 and 1-0 in the Big 12. ISU, with a 3-1 record and a 0-1 record in the Big 12, failed to force a turnover against the defending conference champion Bears, with their 3-1 overall record and 1-0 record in the Big 12, while quarterback Hunter Deckers tossed two interceptions. Penalties greatly aided two of Baylor's touchdown drives, and the Cyclones lost a Big 12 game at home for the first time since a 34-27 setback to Oklahoma State on October 26, 2019. We'll see this week who this team is and how we respond and how we come back, because we're obviously going into another great challenge, ISU head coach Matt Campbell said of Saturday's 2:30 p.m. matchup with the Jayhawks in Lawrence. I think you guys see this league from top to bottom. You're going to get challenged every week, and you better have great poise and leadership to be able to navigate it. An array of capable contributors is required as well. That's where Stanley comes in, but he's not alone in receiving core led by a two-prime first all-Big 12 performer Xavier Hutchinson, who already owns five touchdown catches this season. Sprinkle in skilled sophomore Jalen Noel, who totaled a career-high 120 receiving yards in Saturday's loss, along with Stanley and a cohort of complementary players, and Deckers enjoys plenty of options as he goes through his passing progressions. You talk positives, man. That receiver room, there's some guys that are really starting to come on, Campbell said. Jalen had another really good day. Sean Shaw Jr. last week, and then obviously Dimitri this week. I think those things are positive, and they will serve us well moving forward. That would be 0-1 to start the Big 12 play for the sixth time in Campbell's seven seasons. Baylor's dealt the Cyclones three of those games game one setbacks, but the Cyclones have responded by forging a winning conference record in each of the past five seasons. So there's no panic, just resolve. And the calendar now turns to October, a month in which ISU has won 16 of its past 19 games. In this game, you're always struck with adversity, said Stanley, who nursed a lower body injury most of last season. It's about how you battle through it. Moving on now to Iowa football. Hawkeyes offense making strides, and the photo here shows Iowa running back LaShawn Williams rushing against Rutgers defensive lineman Aaron Lewis and defensive back Christian Braswell during the second half of Iowa's 27-10 win Saturday in Piscataway, New Jersey. Or I think they call it Piscataway. Piscataway, that's how you say it. Okay, Piscataway, New Jersey. Had to remember how Gary Dolphin said that on Saturday. All right, five things to digest after Iowa's Big Ten opening win at Rutgers. It's written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times. There is never anything ugly about a Big Ten road victory. Five things to think about following the Iowa football team's 27-10 victory at Rutgers on Saturday night. Number one, the good. Able to establish a ground game against a run defense that had been allowing 32.3 yards per game, the Hawkeye offense took a step forward Saturday night. It started with stronger cohesion from the front five, creating opportunities for a collection of running backs that was at full strength for the first time this season. LaShawn Williams, Caleb Johnson, and Gavin Williams combined to run for 139 yards, helping open things up for an 11 of 17 passing performance by Spencer Petras that covered 148 yards. The thing that goes unnoticed by a lot of people are those 4, 5, 6-yard runs on first down. Those are big for us, really help get things going, said tight end Sam Laporta, who led Iowa with 4 receptions for 77 yards. Seeing improvement in all three phases, Coach Kirk Ferentz said, with each game, coaches are learning more about the Hawkeye offense, what it can become. We're still not as cohesive as we need to be, but I think we're making progress, Ferentz said. Well, number two, the good to be back. Dealing with the death of his father, running back LaShawn Williams watched Iowa's win over Nevada on television with family members. He celebrated being back with his extended family by leading Iowa in rushing, with 64 yards on 11 carries, including a 2-yard touchdown run in the third quarter, which extended the Hawkeyes' lead 24-3. It felt good to help them get the win, the sophomore running back said, calling his touchdown carry special. That was a beautiful feeling after losing my father, getting that touchdown. That touchdown meant a lot to me. Williams said his coaches and teammates are helping him cope with his loss. The support system, they've all been there for me. I watched all of the Nevada game last week, and afterward, guys were texting me after the game, 3 o'clock, saying they won it for me, Williams said. They're my brothers. Number three, the consistently good. After holding Rutgers to 10 points, Iowa's defense is now surrendering a nation-low average of 5.8 points per game during the Hawkeyes' 3-1 start. The Hawkeyes rank 6th in the country in defending the run and in total defense, allowing 73 yards per game on the ground and 236.2 yards overall. Iowa sits in 14th in pass defense at 163.2 yards per game. Overall, Hawkeye opponents have scored 23 points through 4 games. That is the fewest points allowed by an Iowa defense to start the season in that span in 66 years. The Hawkeyes gave up just 20 points in the first 4 games in 1956. That's pretty impressive. Clearly the guys are really playing at a high level right now, doing a good job, Ferentz said. Well, number four, the better than good. Something about the Big Ten opener brings out the best in the Hawkeyes' defense. For the second straight season, Iowa's defense scored two touchdowns in the opening game of the conference season, with Cooper DeJean finding the end zone on a 45-yard interception return in the first quarter, and Kayvon Merriweather running a fumble back 30 yards in the second. Those turnovers for scores, they changed everything, Rutgers coach Greg Schiano said. We were moving the ball, felt that a lot of things on the play call sheet were working, but we turned the ball over and it made all the difference. Riley Moss returned a pair of interceptions for touchdowns against Indiana in the Hawkeyes' 2021 Big Ten opener, and Merriweather said the similarities had everything to do with readiness. We were just doing what we do, Merriweather said. We may make mistakes in practice on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but when the game comes around, we're ready. Number five, the bad into good. Making the most of a bad situation after cornerback Terry Roberts was a late scratch after aggravating an injury during pregame warmups, Castro stepped in and competed well. In addition to being in a position to make the hit and force a fumble that helped Iowa enjoy a 3-0 edge in turnover margin, Castro finished with four tackles and was one of five Hawkeyes to break up passes during an expanded role. Sebastian was the next guy up, and he came in and made plays, Ferentz said. He's one of those guys who seems to find a different gear in game competition, and I'm hoping this will be a shot in the arm, confidence-wise, for him. Iowa's most significant injury during the game involved linebacker Justin Jacobs, who was seeing his first action since suffering an injury in the season opener. Ferentz said the preliminary report on Jacobs did not look good, but expects to know more as this week progresses. From there, we lead to Leading Off, your guide to the week in Major League Baseball. This is on page B2 of the sports section. And the photo shows American League MVP race between two-way superstar Shohei Ohtani of the Los Angeles Angels and record-chasing slugger Aaron Judge of the New York Yankees is raising a lot of debate. It shows both of those gentlemen up here on the headline photo. Ohtani versus Judge, latest of baseball's great MVP races, reads the headline. That's written by Noah Trister of the Associated Press. When Shohei Ohtani is pitching impressively and hitting over 30 homers, he might always be the MVP favorite unless another player in his league comes up with something awfully special, like hitting 60 home runs, for example. Ohtani and Aaron Judge for the American League MVP figures to be the most hotly debated postseason award this year. Judge is closing in on Roger Maris' AL record of 61 homers and might also win the Triple Crown. He's done it while playing quite a bit of center field for a team that's nearing a division title. Ohtani, on the other hand, is pitching better than he did when he was the unanimous MVP last year. He may even be putting himself in the Cy Young conversation to go along with his 34 homers. According to Baseball Reference's wins above replacement stat, the two are pretty close. Judge was at 9.9 entering Sunday, with Ohtani at 9.0. As phenomenal as he is, there are a couple factors, both last year and this year, that keep Ohtani's WAR a bit below the Barry Bonds, Babe Ruth stratosphere. As well as he's pitched, the Angels are careful about not overusing him. He threw only 130 and a third innings last year and has 153 this year. His lack of defensive value also works against him. That's just nitpicking, of course. If Ohtani doesn't win MVP this time, it will have taken a truly spectacular performance to beat him. Here are a few other famous head-to-head MVP races through the years. We have 1941 with Joe DiMaggio over Ted Williams in the American League. Perhaps the most famous MVP race came in the year DiMaggio had his 56-game hitting streak and Williams hit .406. In 1961, Maris over Mickey Mantle in the American League. This was a close race, even though Maris, who beat out Mantle for the 1960 MVP as well, hit his 61 home runs to break Ruth's record. Mantle played a tougher position, and while this obviously wasn't a factor back then, he had a significant 10.4 to 6.9 edge on Maris in that. And that would be wins above replacement. In 1987 in the American League, George Bell over Alan Trammell. Trammell's Tigers rallied past Bell's Blue Jays for the American League East title, but Detroit shortstop couldn't overcome the Toronto Sluggers' 47 home runs and 134 RBIs. In 1998, the National League, Sammy Sosa over Mark McGwire. McGwire, with 70, outlasted Sosa with 66 in the home run race after both broke Maris' record, but the MVP vote was lopsided in Sosa's favor. His Cubs made the playoffs, and he led the league in runs and RBIs. In 2012, in the American League, Miguel Cabrera over Mike Trout. In a contentious race pitting traditionalists against New Age stats, the Triple Crown winning Cabrera took the MVP, and the vote wasn't all that close. Trout settled for second place despite producing 10.5 wins above replacement, or as it's abbreviated, WAR, as a rookie. After finishing second to Cabrera again the following year, Trout won three MVPs of his own. So from there we go to trivia time. This past weekend, Houston's Dusty Baker became the fourth manager with a 100-win season in both leagues. Who were the others? Comeback of the week, the Kansas City Royals scored 11 runs in the sixth inning Sunday to wipe out a 9-run deficit against Seattle. Kansas went on to win 13-12. Not that we need advanced stats to put that in perspective, but Baseball Savant lists Kansas City's win probability as 0.3% during that sixth inning. The Royals had 5 walks and 7 hits in the inning. Seattle still leads Baltimore by 4 games for the last AL wild card and has a tiebreaker over the Orioles. But if the Mariners do miss the playoffs, this game will be a tough one to forget. The trivia answer, Sparky Anderson, 1970, 1975, and 1976 with Cincinnati, 1984 with Detroit. Whitey Herzog, 1977 with Kansas City, 1985 with St. Louis. And Tony La Russa, 1988 and 1990 with Oakland, 2004 and 2005 with St. Louis. In addition to this year, Baker did it with San Francisco in 1993, his first season as a manager. And believe it or not, we've expelled all the sports for this episode of the Mason City Globe Gazette. Moving on now to more news from page A5. Congress working on lame duck Social Security fix. This may be our last story with the time we have remaining. This written by Laura Weiss of the CQ Roll Call, Dateline Washington, where key lawmakers are eyeing a possible year-end tax package as their best shot at offering a fix for a Social Security provision that many on Capitol Hill believe unfairly cuts benefits for public employees who also have government pensions. The issue was thrust into the spotlight after bipartisan supporters of legislation to permanently boost Social Security payouts by hundreds of dollars a month for nearly 3 million individuals were on the cusp of forcing their bill to the House floor using a special procedural tool. But House Ways and Means Committee leaders, who have been working on their own less expansive compromise plan, one they believe has a better chance of becoming law, turned off the procedural gamut. The House's top tax writers believe they're close to agreement on addressing the windfall elimination provision, which lowers Social Security payouts for individuals who qualify for pensions from their work as teachers, police officers, government employees, and other public sector jobs and for Social Security benefits from separate employment. I'm convinced the best opportunity to repeal the windfall elimination provision and get fairness back to these public servants is to act this year and to focus on the windfall elimination provision, that says House Ways and Means Ranking Member Representative Kevin Brady, who's retiring after this Congress. The Texas Republican said most of the work is done on getting to a bipartisan fix, which could then become part of the year-end tax package that would ride on the omnibus spending package or another legislative vehicle after November's midterm elections. And that ends this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. We are out of time. Thank you so much for listening today, and thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm your reader today, filling in. My name is Andrew Haupt. Thank you so much for joining us, and we appreciate it when you do, and we're so glad to have you here. Have a great day, everyone. Keep it real and straight ahead.